All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you all. Please be seated. Good morning. Welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court, sitting today in Lewiston, Idaho, in what is for us a brand new courthouse, and probably for most of you. It's wonderful to be here and to see the amazing work that's been done in creating this building that is certainly everything we would ever hope a courthouse would be. We thank to the county officers and others who made our visit here so welcome thus far. This morning, the first case before us is Posey versus Bushnell, case number 52072. In this matter, Summer Bushnell appeals, representing herself. You are Summer Bushnell?
Yes.
And for the respondent, Eric Posey, we have Wendy Olson. Counsel, Ms. Bushnell, do either of you have any preliminary matters this morning before argument?
We do not, Your Honor. Thank you.
I would note that Judge Mark Monson is sitting with this court as a pro tem justice. Justice Cynthia Meyer has recused in this matter. With that, it appears, Ms. Bushnell, you've reserved 10 minutes for opening. Is that correct? You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Summer Bushnell, and I'm representing myself. I'd like to focus on three primary issues and then briefly mention one additional one. In overview, my position is this. This case contains three fundamental problems: the absence of causal connection between my conduct and the damages awarded, the imposition of punitive damages without that foundation, and a jury structure that allowed those errors to occur. First, the damages that were awarded are not supported by a causal connection to my conduct. The plaintiff testified in the record that his job loss, one of the foundational harms discussed at trial, was not caused by anything I did, or rather that he was fired for using a racial slur against a customer, and yet damages were still awarded as though that harm were caused by my conduct. For damages to be awarded, there must be a causal link between the conduct and the harm.
Was the job loss the only damages alleged by the plaintiff?
No. He had emotional damages, too.
So isn't it possible that the damage award by the jury was related to the other damages?
Yes, both. I think one was ignored and one was emphasized more.
Defamation per se, which I understand the jury found occurred here, the law presumes damages, doesn't it?
Yes. And if you let me continue, I think the foundation was incorrect, so the damages were inflated. I don't feel that the link was established in the record, and in a key respect, I feel like the plaintiff's own testimony contradicted itself. Punitive damages are reserved for particularly serious conduct, but here they were allowed in a situation where the underlying damages themselves are not clearly tied to my conduct. And with your other questions, so you end up with a case where punitive damages are layered on top of a damages finding that has a faulty foundation.
Except there was a basis to award emotional distress damages.
Yes.
So that's a basis to award punitive damages. I mean, I understand you're attacking causation on the job loss damages, and I'm not saying whether I agree with you or not, but even if we set that aside, we still have evidence supporting an award of emotional distress damages, and so I'm struggling with why you believe there's no basis to award punitive damages.
I think that the emotional and the job loss need to be tied together.
Based on what?
This is where I'm representing myself. Based on previous law and how I've seen other punitive damages be awarded.
Because I didn't see any, I mean, this is where we get into the issues with either cases that didn't exist but were cited in your brief, or cases that you cited that simply don't say what you claim they say. And so I'm trying to figure out, and I understand you told us that that was unintentional, and I'm not doubting that at all. But we're left with a situation where when we strike, and that's what you asked us to do, is don't dismiss your appeal, but just disregard everything that either is a false case or is an, what you explained was an inadvertent misrepresentation. That doesn't leave a lot of law in your brief. The majority of the law you cited in your brief, when I look at it, is either misrepresented or cases that don't exist or don't have the quotations or don't discuss the issues. And so that's why I'm asking you what's left to support your position that Mr. Posey had an obligation to establish both the job loss damages and the emotional distress damages before he could seek punitive damages.
Can you state that last sentence again, because I want to respond?
My understanding is that your position is he had to establish your conduct caused both job loss damages and emotional distress damages before he could seek punitive damages. And I'm asking you what law or case or regulation do you have that says that? Because I'm not sure that the cases you cited in your briefs say that.
Yeah. Hold on, I'm gonna look at some notes I prepared. I don't feel like I have a good response at this time because I feel like our conversation leading up to the hearing was that I was not to cite any law that I didn't already have in my appeals, and then we had discussed that, so I was arguing just based on the merits of the case.
Okay.
All right. Give me just a moment because we skipped over some of my opening. All right, I'd like to briefly address one additional issue from jury selection. I understand that the courts routinely ask whether jurors can follow the law, even if it differs from their personal beliefs. I'm not challenging that principle. I understand the need and the importance here. The issue here is with how that question was framed in this case. The purpose of that inquiry is to determine whether a juror's beliefs would prevent them from following the law. But the way the question was phrased in this case linked setting aside religious belief to being fair and impartial. That distinction matters because it can change how jurors understand what is being asked of them. The phrasing creates a risk that jurors understood fairness to require setting aside their religious beliefs rather than simply following the law. I raise this not only in the context of this case, but because it may benefit from clarification going forward to help ensure that jury selection remains neutral and focused on a juror's ability to follow the law. Rather than suggesting that fairness requires setting aside religious belief, and without that foundation, in my opinion, punitive damages cannot stand. This is not a matter of discretionary raising. The issue was raised at trial through proposed instructions, but was not adopted by the court.
So Ms. Bushnell, since you said earlier that punitive damages are reserved for particularly bad conduct, and you just said a moment ago that you want to focus on facts, help me understand why the facts in this case that the jury believed weren't particularly bad enough to qualify for punitive damages. The allegations in this case of modifying a video and lying about its contents and publicizing it sound pretty serious. Help me understand why it's not as serious as the jury thought it was.
Because I don't feel like they had the right instructions. I felt like they were led and that the court at the time, the district court, didn't give them enough guide rails to go on. And that I maintain that I don't think the punitive damages were anchored in real.
Okay, so you're telling me you didn't like the instructions, but why would the conduct that was alleged and testified to in this case, and some of it admitted, why wouldn't it have not been sufficient under the instructions? Can you talk about the facts and apply them to the jury instructions and tell me why they're not sufficient?
I don't believe they were sufficient because of the way they were worded. I felt like the judge kind of went out of bounds and that he said, we're going to, you have to set aside certain things to be on the jury. So I came into a jury that already was assuming guilt in my case.
So now we're talking about jury bias. That wasn't my question. I'll try one more time. I'm trying to get you to be specific. And very much like your briefing, it's non-specific. It's a lot of word salad that's not really saying anything. Can you give me some specific reason why the jury erroneously concluded that you did something that was particularly bad?
Because I do not agree that I admitted to anything on the stand. I did not have any malice, and I continue to not have any malice toward Mr. Cody.
The jury apparently didn't believe your version, and they
Correct.
Believed the plaintiff's version.
Yep.
If the jury believed the plaintiff's version, would it have been particularly bad?
No, I do not think so.
Why?
Because of my intent, and I felt like I adequately explained that on the stand. And then it becomes a lifetime punishment for me.
Can you be specific in any way about that?
Nothing's coming to mind, I'm sorry. Okay. All right, I will shorten my closing, sorry. I respectfully ask that you consider reversing my judgment and remand for further proceedings consistent whatever you guys think is best. Thank you.
Thank you. Result, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Ms. Bushnell, Your Honors, it is my honor to have represented Eric Posey, the respondent in this case. The jury below awarded him damages in the amount of $1.176 million for the harm that Ms. Bushnell caused when she made false statements that he committed a crime by flashing his genitals to minors. With respect to Ms. Bushnell's argument that there was no evidence of the causation of that her comments caused the damages, they certainly caused the emotional damages. And that information was clear and overwhelming in front of the jury. We set out largely, I think it's at page 4 of our brief, the citations to the transcript where, for example, his boss talked about the impact on him and how it was difficult for him to go out in public. We cite the testimony from his close friends, Sarah Lynch and Jane Clark, who had known him before the performance at Pride in the Park and after, and how they described the emotional impact on him and how every aspect of his life and his ability to go out was damaged by the statements. And these, of course, are statements not made just one time. These are statements made in social media and on posts and reposted. And there was a criminal investigation. Mr. Posey spent 2 weeks not knowing whether he would be charged. He did seek mental health counseling briefly about 2 weeks after the event. And
you mentioned the posting and the reposting. One of the elements, of course, of defamation is publication. Was Ms. Bushnell directly responsible for the repeated reposting of this?
She was not responsible for the repeated reposting. She was responsible for the original posting on her blog, also on Facebook, and then that was picked up lots of other times.
So the fair way to characterize this then is she created the content and others reposted it repeatedly?
Correct. And as well, our argument is that in our presentation to the jury, that's part of what caused the harm. And this was also, she put it out there so that other people would repost it, so it would be picked up on and so people would talk about it. She urged people who saw her post to contact law enforcement and to complain about Mr. Posey's conduct. And the manner in which he did that, which the court already recognized, was in a way that was false. Not only was the statement false itself, but there was the video that blurred over Mr. Posey's crotch area to suggest that if you took the blurring away, what you would see were his genitals. And that wasn't true at all. And the same video included a shot to cut to some children in the audience and was in there to suggest that they were reacting to Mr. Posey exposing his genitals. And that video of the children reacting wasn't even from Mr. Posey's performance. It was from the performance before his. And so the video was false in many respects and designed to elicit the exact kind of response to get people to contact law enforcement. And that caused emotional damage to Mr. Posey. When he saw the, briefly saw the licensed professional counselor, she testified at the trial that when she first had contact with Mr. Posey, he was in visible distress. He had some physiological hyperarousal and cognitive hyperarousal. So he was speaking very pressured, almost pressured. She testified that Mr. Posey was tearful at times and hypervigilant or restless. So absolutely, Ms. Bushnell's false statements, her false video, caused harm to Mr. Posey. And we would submit that the court got it exactly right, that that evidence of emotional damage was sufficient and that it was appropriate to submit the case, to submit the claim on punitive damages to the jury. And Judge Pittman set that out in the record. So there was certainly the causal connection, there was certainly emotional harm, and there was a basis to submit the claim for punitive damages. And it's very clear that the jury considered all of that in returning its verdict. The court has in the clerk's record the verdict form, and the jury parsed it out in three ways. For the first claim, just the verbal defamation, he flashes genitals to minors, they awarded an amount of $300,000. $325,000, I think, 26. And then with respect to the video, the defamation by implication claim, they awarded a higher number of compensatory damages, $600,000. And then the last claim was the punitive damages claim, which was the smallest amount of the damages awarded. So the jury clearly parsed through all of that. And I know that Ms. Bushnell has critiqued in some fashion the punitive damages instructions, but it's clear from comparing the punitive damages instructions that were requested at the time by her counsel with the ones that the court actually gave that the court properly instructed the jury.
Was there anything unusual about the punitive damage instruction, or was it the standard Idaho civil jury instruction that's used in most cases like this?
Well, it was actually a combination, we thought, Your Honor. There was the punitive damages instruction, and then there was an instruction with respect to, in a defamation case, you also had to prove actual malice to get punitive damages. And that, I think, comes from the Elliott versus Murdoch case. And so the judge, over our objection, instructed with respect to punitive damages on both of those things. And what it functionally did was also then raise the bar. It raised the bar for punitive damages, but I think it also demonstrated that when the jury awarded punitive damages, they also really reached the highest level of a standard that they could on a defamation claim.
So from your view, then, the instruction that was actually given was more favorable to the defendant than the one you wanted?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. And so I think for that reason, there's no prejudice to her from the way the court instructed the jury on punitive damages. It's clear that the jury, by finding punitive damages, I think we have to infer that they looked at that and followed that, as we always do with juries when they return a verdict after hearing the court's instructions. That's what they did. And so I think, Your Honor, they were properly instructed. They returned a verdict that was appropriate, and there is no basis for Ms. Bushnell to allege that there was any error in the jury instructions or any error in the manner that the punitive damages issue was handled by the court.
The briefing suggests that the handling of the punitive award violated 616.04 sub 3 in terms of how it was actually calculated, that it exceeded the statutory minimum or maximum. Would you address whether this award of punitive damages complies with the statute?
It does comply with the statute, Your Honor. So as I recall, the statute, what it requires is that the punitive damages amount cannot be more than the greater of $250,000 or three times the compensatory damages award. The compensatory damages award here was over $900,000. So a punitive damages award, and it's always dangerous for me to do math in court, would be okay up to $2.7 million. And so, Your Honor, the amount of punitive damages that were actually awarded are far below that, and so it was completely within the statute. I think her other complaint was because the court didn't instruct the jury with respect to that or give them adequate guidance on how to limit their consideration of punitive damages, that was error. But, of course, what the statute says is the jury is not to be instructed on what this limitation is, and if the damages award exceeds that limitation, then that's handled after the jury's verdict is returned. There was, of course, no motion by counsel to do that here because the punitive damages award is clearly within the statutory amount. And I think, Your Honors, we otherwise will rest on our briefs. We think that the evidence was clear here to prove the defamation claims, clear here to prove that the punitive damages award should go to the jury, and the jury returned such a verdict. We see no error in the jury instructions. And as Justice Mueller, my conversation with Justice Mueller indicates, they were actually more favorable to Ms. Bushnell or favored her. They weren't the ones we had requested. And for that additional reason, this court should affirm in all respects the jury's verdict. Thank you.
Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
20 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Bushnell, when you're ready.
Okay, give me a minute or two. All right, I think I'm ready now. Thank you for giving me a minute or two to collect my thoughts.
All right. I continually, obviously, to vigorously disagree with opposing counsel. I did not lie. I am not responsible for the repeated repostings. But we are not here to discuss the evidence. I'm here to discuss the structure by which the evidence was being considered or not considered. As I mentioned earlier, I feel like the jury did not have the instructions that they had. I continue to assert that I did not have malice. And to address Ms. Olson's part about the blurring of the video, I had repeatedly said at trial, I blurred over the video to meet community standards and social media platforms. Nothing more, nothing less. I would like to get back to what I feel like is the merits of the case, and I'm hoping to, in this section, answer more of what you asked me earlier, now that I've had a little bit of time to collect my thoughts. So my main issue is the required sequence. I felt like the required sequence was not followed. From my research, and I am representing myself, the jury must first determine liability and causation and only then proceed to damages, and then after that, to punitive damages if warranted. In my opinion, that sequence was not enforced.
Ms. Bushnell?
Yes.
Isn't that exactly what happened, though, when you look at what the jury was asked to do first? Weren't they first asked to determine whether Mr. Posey had proved the elements, and then after that,
ask the amount of damages?
I do not feel like the jury instructions led them that way.
But isn't that what the verdict form? That's actually what they did, though, isn't it? They first determined whether or not he had proven his case and then determined damages.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I'm understanding what you're asking.
Well, you're talking to us about the sequence,
yes.
Right? And you felt like they got the sequence wrong.
The guardrails on the sequence wrong, yes.
But as I look at the record, didn't they follow the exact sequence that you're advocating? Didn't they first determine that he had proven his case and then assign an amount of damages?
I do not feel like they were asked to prove the case. I felt like they were asked to decide how guilty I was.
In your brief, you write, the court's final verdict form included phrasing that presupposed wrongdoing and directed the jury immediately to damages questions without a clear neutral liability determination first. Go on. For example, the form's opening interrogatory was phrased in a way that assumed the plaintiff had suffered injury and asked the jury to assign an amount rather than requiring a threshold finding of liability. This structure effectively collapsed the liability and damages phases of deliberation, increasing the risk that jurors would award damages without a clear consensus on whether the defendant's conduct was wrongful under the law. But when I turn to the jury verdict form, the first question that was asked of the jury was, did plaintiff Eric Posey prove the elements of defamation by a preponderance of the evidence against defendant Summer Bushnell? Answer, yes. The jury was clearly asked, did Mr. Posey prove the evidence against you for the elements of defamation? Then the jury was asked, if your answer to question no is yes, or excuse me, if your answer to question number one is yes, state the amount of damages plaintiff Eric Posey has proven against defendant Summer Bushnell for defamation. Answer, $326,000. The jury was asked these questions specifically in the order in which the law requires. I don't understand the analysis that you've provided in your briefing at all. You say the opening interrogatory was phrased in a way that assumed the plaintiff had suffered injury. How? The question was, did Posey prove it? It didn't presuppose anything.
I felt like it was, I guess it's how I interpret the law, and I'm not a legal expert. I felt like that phrasing is saying, how guilty am I?
Asking if he proved the claim against you?
Yeah.
How else would you ask the question?
I guess I would ask it in a yes or no and not, I would not be as precise as that. I would ask it in a more general area.
It was a yes or no.
I'm sorry, I misspoke.
No, I mean, my struggle is you have to ask them, you pled three claims, and you have to ask the jury claim by claim, did he prove it or not? So asking a general question would create more problems because you don't know which claim they believe he proved or if they believed he proved all of them or two of them or one of them. So the law requires one by one, each claim. And I'm struggling with how it suggested guilt to say, did he prove the elements of the claim, yes or no?
Your Honors, please permit me to address the court.
No, it's denied.
That's my spouse. I think I feel like I'm trying to say that I felt like the beginning sequence was tampered so that everything after that had issues. And I feel like I'm still back at the beginning and that you guys are down at the end, and I think that's where I'm having issues answering the questions.
I think I understand your argument.
Yes.
You're suggesting that they were leading questions that pushed the jury towards the result that the plaintiff wanted. And I understand what you're coming from, and you're basing that, as you've said repeatedly today, on your feelings. I'm reading the text. The text asks an open-ended question. Did the plaintiff prove the case for defamation? You're suggesting that that somehow is leading or suggesting an outcome. I'm not sure I read it that way, but can you craft for me a verdict question that would not be leading in the way that you suggest this was? Was there a better way to say it? If this didn't work, what would you have preferred?
I would have preferred, and it's in the area where I felt like from our briefs back and forth recently, that I wasn't allowed to talk about that, but the 90.20.5 that you can download from your website, it had more definitions on the interrogatories at the beginning, if I'm saying the right phrase, that went into specific, like taking the jury instructions of not taking into account my financial and economic situation.
Well, so now you're not critiquing the verdict form, you're critiquing the jury instructions themselves and how they define defamation. Is that really what your complaint is?
No, that was on the verdict form.
Okay. So again, the verdict form typically in a trial doesn't define terms, it just asks the jury for their vote. So again, what would you have this say that would have satisfied you? What did you want that you didn't get?
I don't feel like I got a jury with the proper guidance from the start.
And that's based on the verdict form alone or on the earlier instructions?
On both.
And you understand the purpose of the verdict form.
Yes.
I'm not trying to be patronizing.
I understand.
I want to make sure that we're communicating.
Yes.
And the verdict form is for the results to be recorded. And I'm just, again, not understanding what's missing from the verdict form that you think should have been there.
I feel like the errors were further back than the verdict form and that it was a little bit of the verdict form not mentioning the financial and economic situation. I thought that was the standard form because I had seen it on the Idaho Supreme Court website.
You were represented by counsel at the trial?
Yes.
Were these arguments made to the judge about the verdict form? Was the judge given your proffered requested language? Were there other instructions? Because as I read the transcripts, I understood your counsel to be happy with the instructions on punitive damages. As was already noted by Ms. Olson, they were the instructions your attorney asked for. So
it's called the second. It was the second amended requested jury instruction forms, and then I'm forgetting the title of the damages form. Those have been argued, I would say, I could get my folder, I printed out the dates. I was within a couple months of the trial taking place, and then there was an argument about it, a hearing without the jury present. I'd say it's either day two or day three of the trial, if I'm remembering right.
Well, I think part of the problem is when you talk about jury instruction 9.20.5, that your counsel didn't request that. Your counsel requested 9.20, and the district court gave 9.20. I'm also not sure that what you've included in your brief as 9.20.5 matches even what's on our website as 9.20.5. It looks like there's some additional language, and I'm not sure where that came from, but I think to the Chief Justice's point, you know, one of the big problems is I don't see where your attorney ever asked the court to give an instruction 9.20.5.
Okay. I felt, I guess from my self-representing point of view, I felt like that was covered previous to the trial, then on the third day of the trial, and you're saying it was not covered. Is that my understanding? I'm just repeating it so I make sure I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm just not seeing. You're one of the things you're telling us is I think the jury, if I'm understanding you correctly, is I think the jury wasn't instructed properly because the jury didn't get the model jury instruction 9.20.5.
Yep.
I'm telling you, I'm not seeing where your attorney below requested the district court to give that instruction.
Okay. Because then my understanding from reading the self-representing appellate handbook, then it cannot be discussed because it wasn't objected to in the trial.
That's the general rule, and that's why I think the Chief Justice is asking about it, and I'm following up on it, is if there is somewhere in the record that you're aware that your attorney asked for that instruction to be given, we need you to let us know.
I thought that was done in the second amended request, but I may be mistaken in that.
In the second amended?
Jury instruction of the long title one, yeah.
You've stated a couple of times during our conversation this morning that you felt like there was something that you couldn't talk about I'm asking you upon what basis you believe there's something that you're not allowed to talk about here.
I thought based on your guys' brief about my citations and then my response that I was agreeing that I would not cite specific law because you guys were concerned about it.
Not
so I was focused.
Law, not specific law at all. It was false law. It's law that didn't even exist. That's what you're not allowed to cite to a court. You have to cite law that was truly law. And that was the point. You didn't ever say, don't cite us any law. That's how you read it?
That's how I read it. And I think with some of them, I misstated them. Like, I was trying to follow other appeals that I had seen online and stating, like, one of them, I'm grasping on the name, but I did not state that it was not an Idaho case. It was South Dakota, and it was the Supreme Court of South Dakota. And I know that's an error on my part where I didn't adequately express the citation.
Well, I guess just putting it out there, when I read your brief, and I think about the world of AI today, I can't help but think that maybe in preparing briefing and that maybe you used an AI resource, that you may have uploaded documents at various times, fed information to AI to help you shape your arguments and things here today. But the problem is, for example, like when I read that section of your brief talking about what was wrong with the jury verdict form, I mean, the analysis was just, in my view, wrong. And so the briefing that you've submitted is providing improper legal analysis, improper legal citations. And it's one of the problems that exists when self-represented litigants, or frankly, even attorneys, rely on a computer resource to generate information and briefing to this court. Because we go through the briefing line by line, case by case, jury instruction by jury instruction. And you see the problem that we have. It's not a matter of wanting to silence you.
No, I don't think
but it's it, but it's a matter of you having to come in to this court and provide proper legal analysis and proper legal authority. You aren't exempt from the rules that lawyers have to play by.
Correct. I am a good writer. I am not a legal expert. I feel like the only area where I used help for research was topical cases, which apparently I misunderstood the conversation we had a couple weeks ago because I had looked up case law, you know, what cases apply, you know, what are defamation cases in Idaho, defamation in the United States. And that's the only way I had used that.
Well, Ms. Bushnell, to Justice Brody's point and to the Chief's point, one of the big problems the court has is the existence of completely fictitious sites, and you're quoting cases where the propositions that you're quoting and the authority that you're quoting just simply doesn't exist.
And with some of them, like I had said in my response, I had not adequately said this part's from this one, this part's from that one, that's part's from that one.
Well, even
and
more
that
than
was
that.
That was an error on my part that I had.
But even more than that, there are numerous citations that are just, and I'm going to use the word fake, they just don't exist. And you're telling us that you had done your own research and there are some issues with some of the citations, but it goes beyond that because you're citing to us authority in support of your positions that it doesn't exist anywhere. And how do you explain that?
And I felt like in our conversation, your concerns that you'd sent to me and in my reply, that I had said I would drop almost all of that and just talk based on the merits. Did I not convey that well?
I think you conveyed that well.
Okay.
And I think Justice Zahn had indicated earlier that one of the concerns with that is if you drop all of that, there's very little left because
yes.
So much of it was either misquoted or created out of whole cloth. And so that's the concern that we've got when we're analyzing this.
And I felt like I knew that going in, that I was just going to argue just based on the merit. And I think that's where Chief Justice had thought maybe I thought I couldn't say things. I thought, okay, I'm agreeing in my reply to your brief that I won't mention that stuff because I had made errors and miscited stuff.
Yeah, just speaking for myself, Ms. Bushnell, I appreciate your attitude and not you haven't sought to blame AI or to blame your attorney or to blame anybody. You've accepted responsibility for that, and I credit you for that. But I'm not sure of the irony of this if it's dawned upon you. Trials are quests for truth. This is a case that's about allegedly telling lies about someone to hurt their reputation. And then you file documents that are filled with untruths because of the sources that you filed. And it just seems to me that everything about this case has been to divert the jury or divert the judges or to divert the public, for that matter, from truth. And
no.
You put those things all together in this case, and it just doesn't look good.
I don't know how to dissuade you from that opinion. That's not my intent.
But you can see that's what appears to have happened.
My intent is to make sure that the structure was followed. I just think the structure was not followed correctly. I'm not sure I have anything else to say, but I really appreciate all your questions. I'm sorry if I did not. Thank you for taking the time and the patience to flesh them out with me, and I appreciate you hearing my case. Thank you.
Time spent to be here today and present your statement and arguments to the court on both sides. The court now does what we call take the matter under advisement. That means that the five of us will talk about the case and come to a resolution that will be eventually written out in an opinion and determined down the road. But as of this time, it is under advisement. Thank you. We'll be in recess for approximately 15 minutes.
All rise, please.